All right, it is my turn to ask the question. And the question this week is, how do you manage your obligations to the people who appear in your poems?
I ask before I try to publish anything or even think about publishing, and I ask anybody like from my life who I'm including in a recognizable way. I ask them if they're okay with it, and I show it to them. I don't know if that makes sense. Even then I'm still putting pressure on the person to say yes. Like it's an awkward position for them, and maybe it means that I'm limited in my imagination in some ways, but like I think if I weren't doing that, I would just be so distracted by the fear that they were going to hate me that I couldn't even concentrate to write.
Okay. Well, that's like a pretty straightforward and very upfront and sensible way to go about it. Like, I've never thought to do
I mean,
that.
I imagine some people would be appalled by the idea of doing that.
Really? Why?
I don't know. I feel like it could read as like unserious, not committed to the art, not being willing to tell the truth. Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I think a lot of people would be put off by that idea.
I mean, the famous example that everybody goes to when we talk about this topic is Robert Lowell's The Dolphin, where he took Elizabeth Hardwick's letters to him. And I have a copy of The Dolphin, but I've never actually read it. So I'm just kind of guessing as to what's in there. But my understanding is it's her letters distorted by him to make a story.
And if I remember correctly, like her letters to him after he left her for somebody else.
Yeah, so they're not going to be particularly complimentary. And he doesn't ask Elizabeth Hardwick, but he does ask Elizabeth Bishop in a way. Like he writes to her, because the story always gets told like, oh, this bishop said, oh, it's not worth that much. You shouldn't put this book out. Please don't do it. Like she basically begs him. I have read the letters between them, but not the book. But it strikes me talking about it today that what he's actually doing there, even though he ignores her advice, is he's kind of wanting someone to reassure him that it's okay that he's doing this. He doesn't get that reassurance and he goes ahead and publishes the book anyway. But why else send it to Elizabeth Bishop if he doesn't want his best friend in poetry to say, wow, what an amazingly creative thing you've done, Robert?
I imagine he sent, from what I know, most of his things to her. But yeah, I mean, she cared deeply about Hardwick. I'm sure he was hoping for her blessing.
Yeah, so that's like the horrifying example where it's like the poet puts the work not only above the relationship, but like really takes an axe to the remainders of the relationship with a book.
And like there are all kinds of other complicating factors there. You know, Hardwick is a writer and he's using her words, and he's using words of hers that she hadn't prepared for publication. That, you know, like it's like there are layers of shittiness on top of just the revelation of her without her permission.
It's pretty abominable, really, when you think about it. But oh well, we love Robert Lowell. So that's one extreme. I don't think I would follow your example with asking people for their permission, partially because I feel that I would be, in doing that, I would be maybe making the poem seem more important than it really was, at least in my case. Like part of the reason that I feel I can get away with including recognizable versions of real people and real relationships in my poems is that I really think art isn't worth that much. Like, I just don't think it matters too much if I put it in a book that's going to sell 20 copies. Like, it's okay. It's not going to, like, it's not even the same as talking about someone on a podcast, really.
No, I mean, like, you know, the 20 people who buy the book are going to be your friends who, you know, are quite likely to be the people who know that other person as well.
Oh, that's true, I suppose. Yeah. But also, it's in a poem. Like, it's such a small thing.
Let me push you a little bit, because I know you have one poem that I love that's about a real person that you've been hesitant to publish. So I mean, there is a line for you somewhere, right?
So I have a poem about a family member that like I have really worked on for probably 3 years, and with your help finally managed to get it to a place where it's complete. I'm trying to find ways for it to do something in the world without it being published on the internet or in print in Australia. So I was looking for like a print opportunity in the US, and now at the moment it's with a competition, because very often like if you get runner up in a competition, like nobody knows what the poem is because they don't print it. So I'm like, maybe it'll hit that sweet spot. I don't know. But that is kind of like that's one of my test cases, is like, what could I, because I do think it's like, I like it. I think it is pretty decent. I certainly don't want it to be read by any members of my family. I guess I'm, as usual, trying to have it both ways, where I'm like, I want my little bit of like, I want the poem to do what it can do, but I don't want to hurt anyone. And really, if I were more scrupulous, I would just like shelve it and be like, well, you wrote that, but it's never going anywhere.
So maybe this is getting on too much of a tangent, but what do you think would happen if you shared it with the family member?
Oh, like the relationship would be over. Like it would
Right.
be like completely devastating, and also against, like directly counter to a lot of like really important relationship repair work that I did, you know? So like it would just be so pointless and actively damaging.
I mean, that's kind of what I fear is like, even if like the poem goes nowhere, I still feel like, and even never gets published, like I'm still kind of, so, like Caroline, my wife, comes up a lot in my poems, and I'm still like, if I submit it somewhere, I'm still sending it to some person and like, telling that person something about my wife. And like, I don't know why Caroline married me, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't for my poems. So it would kind of suck for her to like have to, and maybe it wouldn't, but like I feel like it would be unfair to her to have me just like running around talking about her life to strangers and to people we know without her having a say in it. But again, I know other people would feel completely different, but like I just, the idea of someone being justifiably angry with me is just, I don't have the maturity to deal with that.
No, I mean, I also feel like in this instance, because like you can make honest mistakes in life and people can be justifiably angry with you, and that's something that you just have to work through. That will happen as you live your life. But in this instance, what we're talking about is like a premeditated act of exposing someone. And again, it's in a poem, so it's not even like you're talking about them on YouTube or like, I don't know. Like it seems to me like it's a very small way to expose somebody, but it is still an exposure of some kind.
Even if it ends up being small, I think our ambitions for it are pretty big. We're trying to make something important and meaningful. We're trying to make something that's going to affect people. So like I get the impulse to say, well, my poems aren't that important, but that's not what I'm after when I'm sitting down writing the poem.
Yeah, and this is a big tension between me and all of you guys, is because I just like see that equation very, very, very differently. But that's okay. That's a conversation for another day. Another example that I have that is a real example of where this kind of went wrong, that I've already talked about elsewhere. It's like, not only have I done the exposing, but now I'm talking about doing the exposing, so it's like nice. Yeah, I wrote this poem called Bad Boys for Life about my friends from Canberra, all of whom were guys. We used to drive to Sydney from Canberra, which is like a 3 hour drive. And my memory of the way that it would go is we would all hop into Wayne's car or someone's car. And at a certain point, about half an hour into the drive, we're surrounding Lake George, and somebody would put on this song, Bad Boys, which is unfortunately by Diddy. But the refrain is, We can't be stopped now because we're bad boys for life. And I just thought this was hilarious because these boys were not bad in any sense. They were so not bad. They're like the least bad.
Not even aspirationally.
Not even aspiration. Like, yeah, the stuff that the worst that they got up to was like putting a wheelie bin on top of a bus shelter. Like that kind of stuff. So I wanted to write a poem about, hey, you guys are not bad, but PS, I still think about all that and I still really deeply miss like spending time with you in that way when we were younger. But in writing the poem, I ended up including details that were like real details really about the people in that group. And then eventually, because I was really proud of it, I ended up showing it to a couple of them, and one of them eventually like recognized one of the details and was like, hey, what the fuck? And yeah, that was like a really sobering moment because yeah, I'd worked really hard on the poem. I was quite proud of it. People had been really kind about it and said nice things, and it felt like it meant something to a few people. My hope was that it would be meaningful to the boys in question. But instead, it felt like it sort of created a moment of this one boy in particular feeling like really exposed and taken advantage of and used. So even though it was just a little poem that ended up on the internet, it was like, oh, damn, probably there's a loss of trust there.
So I'm curious, when you're writing about real people who are real and immediate to you, is it on your mind? Is it just kind of like, I'm just going to write and I'll think about it later? Are they there? Are there possible reactions there with you?
Not usually. I think with the poem about the family member, it was there a bit more. And I did think about what would it mean if this poem actually did go somewhere? What would be the concrete effect of that? But usually no, because usually I'm writing without the expectation that much of anything will happen. And yeah, like I try to get as much down as feels important to me in that moment. And then like there's oceans of editing time that you can use to like if you're like, okay, well actually this is publishable, then you can go back and sort of give it its like Photoshop, make it palatable.
I ask in part because I was trying to think about what effect it has on me that I know I'm gonna show whoever the person is. And like I was trying to think, okay, is there any value? Like is there anything good that comes of it? And I was thinking about, the idea people talk about a lot that makes sense, which is that writing and meter, writing and rhyme, it causes you, it pushes you to come up with new ideas, new perspectives, whatever. And so it's like, well, does it do that for me? And I'm not sure it does that, but I've come up with a harebrained theory for what it might do for me.
Okay.
One of the things, and we've talked about this before, but maybe not on this podcast, one of the things that I increasingly find appealing about writing, one of the reasons it's kind of so stabilizing or whatever it is for me, is that I'm a control freak and life is just uncontrollable. I teach kids who are as young as 12 years old who are immensely uncontrollable. I think when writing it feels meaningful to me, like the act itself, not what I'm going to create, I think part of the reason that I enjoy that or find it meaningful is I'm able to reduce life or experience or an idea or whatever is to a small enough number of variables that there's a chance that if I move them around enough and swap them out in the right ways, and those variables aren't just what happened, it's how the poem sounds, it's what perspective I'm taking, all those things. But that if I spend enough time moving them around, I can get to a place where they're going to click, hopefully, plausibly. And so it's a kind of puzzle, but I've quoted my former professor before, the serious play. So it's a puzzle, but it's a puzzle that feels like it's more than just me doing the crossword or whatever I would be really impatient doing. And the risk of that is that you end up having too much control. I end up having too much control. I think maybe there's a value in the fact that one of those variables has a foot outside the poem. And sometimes the place outside the poem where that foot is like the next room over. And so I think maybe it does put a kind of pressure on my imagination to keep me from cheapening it in some of the ways that I'm capable of cheapening it. Now, maybe also I end up cheapening it because I don't want to, because I want to be kind, or I want to have this person like me and love me, or whatever it is. But I don't know, that's my best case scenario.
And have you ever had an instance where you put something together, you've used that control in exactly the right way, and you've been honest and satisfied the needs of the poem, but also tried to think about that other person, shown it to them, and then they've said, please don't put this out?
No, and again, part of that's because what I'm doing is a little bit fraudulent. Like, because I'm putting them in a really unfair position where, they know I've worked on this thing for a long time, and if they say no. But what I have had is moments where someone said, "Well, this thing right here, the book that I have coming out next year, there's a lot about my parents in it because I'm writing about Lyndon Johnson, who was president when they were first kind of getting together, like before I was born." And I was really worried about, I was really kind of using their lives and sort of using my experience of their lives. And my mom just said, "Well, this one thing where you say what did I said that she'd like done something to follow my dad's place." She's like, "That's just not true, and it's kind of insulting." And so she was able to tell me what was more accurate. That didn't make the poem, I think, any less interesting. There have been times when Caroline has said, "Let me think about it," and she eventually come around and said yes, or maybe just this one thing. But there's never been a thing where like no, this thing doesn't go out in the world, which comes down to especially Caroline being really generous with me because I have used her quite a bit.
The joke in our house, whenever I'm starting in on a new poem, if I tell Tom that I'm doing that, he immediately says, "Is it about me?" And I always say, "No."
The one for us is like one of the first times like Caroline and I were like far enough along that I was like, okay, this is like a real thing, and I'm gonna write about it because it's not gonna be like gone by the time I finish the poem. It's continuing. And so the first time I said, okay, I've written a poem and you're in it, do you mind looking at it? The first thing she asked me was, am I naked in it? Which, it's one of those things you just say, no, it was like, well, no, but also like there are no pictures.
Am
But
I
so
naked?
that's kind of our running joke now. Am I naked?
Oh, that's so cute. Tom always says, "Is it about me?" And I always say no, because this is sort of a sidebar, but like, I don't feel like I need to write about Tom because we have a wonderful, loving, supportive relationship. And so, like, there's nothing there for me to, it's reading the Tom Garn biography, which we referenced last episode. His closest, like, this man is not exactly his husband, but he's as good as. And the only poem he writes about him is that one that you wrote about, The Hug. And for years, he's like, "Where's the poem about me?" And Tom Gunn's like, "Ah, it doesn't work that way. Like, this is too, it's too peaceful. There's nothing to say, there's no irritant."
So I've historically been really bad at relationships, like in like just stereotypically stupid ways. Like I get into a relationship, I panic, I flee, and so like by the time I got together with Caroline, I really hadn't been in many relationships that had lasted a really long time.
How old were you when you guys got together?
Guessing I was like mid-30s. Yeah, mid-30s. So like I'd been screwing up for a good bit by then.
Breaking some hearts, Jonathan.
No, just being a fuck up. But I read this book that like has continued to shape my thinking about relationships ever since. I want to say the guy's name was David Mitchell, and it was called Can Love Last? Which is like a really corny title, but I found the book really, really interesting. Part of his premise is that relationships are inherently dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
We meet in this moment, and we love each other and desire each other in this moment. And 5 minutes from now, or 24 hours from now, or 2 years from now, I'm a different person. And this other person is a different person. And eventually there's enough difference between those two. It's like almost like, okay, does this person still love and desire this person? And then 2 years down, does it? And his claim is that we are deeply aware of this and very afraid. So he spends a lot of time talking about cheating, which was not my thing. My thing was just running and hiding. But he says, the reason people cheat is they tell themselves they're bored, but in fact, the boredom is a function of trying to domesticate the thing that's actually like maybe one of the scariest things in your life. And so we work so hard to like manage our relationships to make them less scary that we convince ourselves that like there's no risk and no excitement. And so we go to these other relationships or hookups or whatever that actually are in many ways less dangerous. They're less vulnerable, and that's he claims why people cheat, which sounds like a kind of like overly broad interpretation, but like that notion of what a relationship is really moved me and persuaded me. And so I don't know, I feel like even a good relationship is really complex and also deeply entangled with every other part of my life. And part of this is that I write these great big baggy things these days. So like, I'm not just writing about one thing at a time. But yeah, like, as someone who doesn't have the imagination not to write about my own life, it's sort of inevitable that Caroline in particular would come up over and over again.
Yeah, I'm the same. I don't really want to write about things that aren't my own life, particularly.
I tried to. I
You
tried to write a
tried
whole
to.
fucking book that was nothing about me. And then people kept saying, there should be more of you in this. And fuckers are right. And so now it's another fucking book about me. And also, I'm not very good at making things up. Like,
No, me
I
neither.
really don't have the imagination for it. Like, even when I was trying to write a book that wasn't about me, I was writing a nonfiction book, reading lots of, gathering up lots of facts from other people's writing to try and put them together. So I do have a story about another way that you can manage this. My friend Dan years ago wrote a nonfiction book about his family called How to Be a Family. They moved around to different places in the world, and he kind of wrote about what parenting was like in each one. But like, it was very much a book about his family and the two kids. So the way he managed it with his older daughter, who was and is very literary, is that he just let her write a rebuttal at the end. So the
Oh,
last
that's
couple pages are
great.
just Lyra being like, here's everything my dad got wrong.
I love that.
Yeah,
I
that's
love that.
fantastic. It's a great ending.
That's fantastic. I'm a big fan, not maybe not fan. I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but I read a lot of recovery memoirs. And there's one in particular that everybody recommends, which is called The Night of the Gun by David Carr. And the conceit of this book, because like most recovery memoirs, it's like, I was a fuck up, I hit rock bottom, then I did this, and now I'm better. And they're very satisfying to read along some axes, and they're also just all exactly the same in another way. But The Night of the Gun is different because David Carr is a journalist, and he starts with this like question in his mind. He has a memory of a night where he went to a friend's house. Totally like drunk and high, and brandished a gun in his face. It was like, you've got to, I don't know what he wanted. He wanted like more coke or something, but like, he's like, I threatened you with a gun, didn't I? And they sort of talk about it for a bit. And eventually he's like, no, I had the gun. Neither of them can remember who had the gun on the night. And so David Carr is like, okay, if that detail's not right, what else am I wrong about? And there are other things that he did, including most significantly leaving his twin baby girls in a car for a very long period on a very cold night because he needed to go and score. And he's just like, I need to figure out what I actually did. So he goes around and he interviews everybody who had anything to do with him in his like drinking and drugging days, and he writes this memoir. And it's great until it gets close to the present day. And then you start to realize that David Carr has lost his appetite for being as like punishingly objective about what he did because his kids are older. He's writing about them in real time. He's writing about his wife. He's writing about his relapse, which of course came. And he's like trying to sort of make it into the recovery sort of narrative where everything's around out and is good again. But the reality is that the end is kind of messy and it involves some like really tough stuff for real people. So yeah, that's kind of why I say like it's only a poem, because I read books like this and I'm like, fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder too if part of what happens is that the fuck up he was 20 years ago is almost like a different person.
Different person, like you were
But the
saying.
fuck up he was 16 months ago is kind of still
Still
him.
him, exactly.
And I guess that's the other thing we haven't really talked about, which is since we're writing about our own lives, like how like the harder thing for me, I think, is not trying to take care of the presentation of myself. Like I'm always I have this terrible habit of like trying to show that I get it and make sure because it's a version of me, but it's a version of me, and so I tend to over explain and like insulate in all kinds of ways, and I think it's easier. Not that it's easy, it's easier for me to find a way to write about somebody else that's, what's the line? Not unkind and not untrue, but I really sort of, it's one of the places where I think I most need help from other people is to just call out all the places where I'm just putting insulation around the presentation of myself.
Yeah, that's funny because I actually have the opposite problem where I need people to call me out for being too hard on myself in my poems. It's like Tom, even in my like essays and nonfiction, he's like, why do you always make yourself sound like so essentially like such a loser? I'm like, I don't know. I'm just like trying to be honest, but maybe I'm like hit going too hard.
But for me, being hard on myself is oftentimes how I create the insulation.
Yeah, you get there first.
Yeah, exactly. I show that I know I got it. It's just putting up all these flags of self-awareness and self-critique that really are kind of false. Even if I believe they're accurate, they're false.
Yeah, that's the thrilling thing about this book. It really does feel in the first half of the book, at least, that he is being like clinically accurate about what happened. And then that kind of falls away. But I mean, that's the other thing about like, even I read a lot of literary biography as well. And I read, it's not a literary biography, I guess, but I read this book by Cynthia Carr, which is The Life of David Wonorowicz. Do you know this artist? He was like a, oh, well, how would you even describe him? He was working in New York in the early 80s. He was very like itinerant, lived on the edges of society, is most famous for doing a lot of like stencils and paste ups inside the wharves around meatpacking. I adore him. Like, I find his work like to be some of the most exciting stuff I've ever seen in my life, and he's like a huge inspiration for my poetry. But he was a total asshole. He was like the absolute worst. So evil to his friends sometimes, like so just they would say like something that was completely innocuous, and he would like essentially like jump out of a moving car or like kick them out on the side of the road and be like, I'm never speaking to you again. Like, he was crazy because he had this intensely fucked up childhood. But yeah, I think about Cynthia Carr, like any biographer really, trying to write the story of another person's life, and how over time you must end up with an obligation, a sense of an obligation to them, to show them in their best possible light, even when they're pretty awful people. Like the other one that I read recently was Savage Beauty, which is Nancy Milford's Life of Edna St. Vincent Millay. And you can tell that Nancy Milford has fallen in love with Millay, and we're not getting some really important stuff because she was kind of awful. It's like, yeah.
I don't know how many years ago now, more than a few, there was a new biography of Philip Larkin that came out.
Oh, yeah.
And the first one was, I think, by Andrew Motion,
Yeah,
maybe.
I think that's right. Yeah.
And I had read that one long ago, and I think a lot of people really resented the previous biography. They felt like it was cruel to Larkin and unfair to him. I didn't find it to be that at all. I found it to be like a moving portrait of a guy who could be horrible, but it never felt cruel or unfair, and it never felt like hateful or vengeful. So anyways, this new biography, no longer new, I guess, came out, and it felt to me like it was so determined to, like, not so much defend him as just protect him,
From
but it
himself.
really, kind of, or from, like balancing the scales, but not balancing the scales by making a case, balancing the scales by just like putting these things behind glass.
Yeah.
And I really felt that, like, by the end, the author just got exhausted with it, and he just almost felt like he was bored with Larkin to me. And there's a coda to the story. So this is when I was writing for Slate, and I wrote a review of the book that was pretty critical. And the guy who wrote the book found my email address at the school where I teach
No.
and sent me this like pages long email.
No.
He did point out one thing that I got factually wrong, which just like I did want to throw up when I realized I'd
No, that's,
gotten it wrong.
yeah.
But like it was more like he just kept telling me about all the great reviews the book had gotten, just going on and on about how like this was just completely inaccurate. And this person said this in The Guardian, and this person said this, and I don't know, the New York Times, I don't know where it was. It was really remarkable to me that like one bad review was such a big deal. I'm pretty disinclined to write negative reviews generally for all kinds of reasons, one of them being cowardice. I couldn't feel any compassion for this guy because he handled it so badly. But, I don't know where I'm going. So I guess it just, it does matter what we say about people.
It's a good point, actually, because we sort of framed this conversation around poems, but you've done so much work as a reviewer, and I've done like a little bit of work as a reviewer, but also I suppose like some stuff on Poetry Says, particularly towards the end, was like a little riskier in terms of talking about real poets who were writing at the time that I was recording, and yeah, probably did hurt some feelings at times. But I think when you're coming at it from a critical standpoint, you really are like protected because of like the expectation that as a critic you're going to do your work honestly, whereas as a poet it's sort of different.
Also, when I was at Slate, this other critic got in touch with me. Well, no, he didn't get in touch. He posted online about how kind of bloodless he thought the reviews were that I was writing. And like I read it, I was like, he's not entirely wrong. It was at a point where I was starting to think, I'm not sure about some of what I'm doing here.
Okay.
And so I emailed him, and we ended up emailing back and forth, kind of like having a discussion about it. And he really wanted, he believed that reviews should be, the word he used was feisty. And like he was really in favor of like the takedown. I thought he was right. I thought he was right about my reviews, but wrong more generally. And one of the things that just really struck me is he was so convinced that, like, you have to be aggressive in these negative reviews and you have to go for blood. But he kept telling this story about how something he'd written, some people thought it was, I don't know if it was sexist. Anyways, they were put off by something he'd written, and like some people attacked him online, and like it clearly was like this just festering wound for him. And I kept saying, well, you seem pretty outraged about the criticism you've gotten. Like it was peculiar. Like, I don't know. I'm so aware of how easily wounded I am, and I'm so aware of the potential for people to be angry with me that like I just can't. There's a point where like we need to correct the record and broaden the conversation and everything. But I don't know. I enjoy some takedowns. I enjoy some vicious reviews. But they're a pretty guilty pleasure for me.
I guess where I kind of come down on all this is it's just about what you personally can live with. Like, probably part of the reason that that wound was such a festering wound for that particular writer was because, on some level, he knew that he'd kind of fucked up. But instead of like trying to amend that, he was like doubling down.
Maybe I don't, I got some people who were really angry with me for I thought mostly positive review. I wrote almost entirely positive review. I wrote about Patricia Lockwood,
Oh, yeah.
and it got kind of aggregated among some reviews that I thought were genuinely sexist. I mean, maybe I'm lying to myself. I still don't think my review was sexist. In fact, I don't think it was negative. But boy, did it bother me to have people online. It sometimes in prominent places calling me a sexist. So I think it just sucks to have people saying you're a bad person.
Yes, indeed. It really does. It really does. Yeah, and more than once in our conversation so far, you've used this word coward, like you've described yourself as a coward. I don't know. I don't know if that's like entirely right. I mean, is it brave to go for blood? Is that courageous?
I guess I'm describing my awareness of my motivations. Like, no, it is not brave to go for blood, especially like given that there are lots of places where you can be valorized for doing that. It's just that I don't want people to turn around and say mean things about me. That's my motivation.
But who does? Like, who would want that? That sounds awful.
But that like sure, but that's like that is much more of a controlling motivation for me. I'm not saying everybody's. Yeah, there are obviously people who like love to troll and do all that. But like, no, most people don't like it. But many people find other things more compelling and more motivating. Not me.
And look, I obviously, maybe it's not obvious, but I definitely struggle with my own impulses to try to please people. But, there's a funny meme, which is where I get most of my therapy from. It's a funny meme that is like, you say you're a people pleaser. People are not fucking pleased. Like, like, when was the last time people were actually pleased with you?
Not only are you a people pleaser, but you're bad at it.
Well, no, but because people pleasing is like a dishon it's dishonest. It's
Yeah.
not like
Yes, that is very true.
it's just completely about me wanting, like you say, to control others' view of me. And that can't be the, like, not only is it dishonest, but it makes you very lonely because you just create this like version of yourself that goes out into the world that is not you. It's just all about like, oh, how am I being perceived at every single moment? So poetry is a place where I get to not do that for a short time, but it does suck when people say mean things about you. It sucks when, like, I can't stand hurting people. The other night I was at a poetry reading and I had a really, really awful time, absolutely horrible night. And as I was leaving, I'm ashamed to say I like threw a little bit of a barb at a couple of guys who'd had been part of making my night horrible. And as I was leaving, I was like, "P.S. Fuck you." And like, I feel so bad. And I'm probably going to see one of them today, and I feel like I need to apologize to him because, much as he was a bit of a dick, I absolutely was a dick. Like, I need to clean that shit up. But yeah, what was my point with that? People pleasing, no one's pleased. That's the other side of it, right? It's like you spend all this time like mincing around trying to make people like you, and then you get really angry and you're like, I fucking actually hate you. Like,
Well, I mean, at least you didn't knock anybody over this time.